G'day expats, welcome to another episode of Expat Chat, episode 30. Today I'm joined with my co-host, friend, colleague, Brett Evans, who is the Managing Director for the EMEA region of Atlas Wealth. How are you going, Brett?
Mate, well thanks. All good over here in the Western Hemisphere. And for those listening and watching, I'm joined by my colleague and friend, James Ridley, who's the Managing Director for the Asia and the Americas region for the Atlas Australia office. James, how's all the protests, mate?
Oh, gosh. And unfortunately, at the moment, Australia's going backwards. You look at New South Wales, their daily cases are in the 800s now, so I think they've gained that critical mass where they're just going to keep compounding on that until they get the vaccinations aggressively rolled out. Queensland's very lucky. You know, we've got no sort of active community cases, which is great to see. And then Melbourne, they're back up to sort of the 60s and 70s. And then I think what was really interesting that came out over the weekend and quite funny, you had the protests that were going in Melbourne, which were rather violent.
Yeah.
And then on the Gold Coast here, down at Coolangatta and Tweed, we had our own little small freedom and protest. And there was a guy that was running around on a horse. And I think it's probably made news around the world. I mean, it's pretty interesting. So what do you think of it, Brett?
As I said before the call, it reminded me of a scene out of Braveheart. He was trying to channel William Wallace and fire up the protesters and making his comments. The police can't hold the wall back, and we both made the comment he was missing a bit of blue paint on his face and maybe a couple of swords. But anyway, it was humorous to say the least. Anyway.
He could have just had the State of Origin colours coated all over him, to be honest. They'll never take our freedom. it's a bit ridiculous, but I guess, the quicker everyone gets on with the vaccination program, the quicker that we'll be in a better situation. Borders can reopen. But they made an interesting comment over the weekend. We'll never obviously eradicate the virus, but there's obviously a better way to handle it compared to how we're handling it now. So we just need to acknowledge that and crack on.
Learning to live with it, getting back to zero is a figment of everyone's imagination now. A time at some in the past, it was 2020, it's now 2021. I'm not exactly saying embrace COVID, but don't give it a kiss or a cuddle, but just acknowledge it, give it a cursory nod to your head, and get on with the job.
Yeah, that's right. Vaccinations, treat it like a flu or a cold, and kick on with it so we don't keep having these circuit breakers. I think it's probably a bit obvious that we'll go into another period of probably contraction with GDP and probably record that recession again. It'll be another, ideally a short recession, and then pop back out of it at the end of the year or either early next year. And then I guess outside of that, we'll just have to see what comes on. It was very interesting, your comments earlier just about the Australian dollar. Seems to be just winding back now, 72. A couple of weeks ago, now we're looking at 71. Seems quite comfy at 71. I mean, again, with the amount of US dollars around, I thought it would have been a lot higher than that. But I guess an important point you made is, our currency and what it's tied to.
We're a commodity currency.
That's right. Yep.
We're a commodity currency. And when the iron ore price goes from 220 to 160, that's a big fall.
Yep. Yeah, exactly right. It's huge. I mean, it's benefiting expats overseas, sending money back to Australia from a USD to AUD, but any expats that are looking to, or soon to be expats, move overseas, taking a big hit on the currency there, big time. I mean, anyone that's in the UK or heading over to, I suppose, the US as well, big time. So key considerations. And I suppose a talking point or topic that we wanted to run over today was, I suppose, how, you should be managing your personal finances as an expat, just because we see it day in and day out. But before we get into this topic,
jingle time.
That's right.
Jingle time. All the information that you have the pleasure and the privilege of listening to and watching today should be construed as purely entertainment by two guys with good heads for radio. And please don't construe this as personal financial advice.
That's exactly right. So moving into it, I suppose wanted to talk about how to manage your finances as an expat. And I suppose the reason why just this general topic is a common thing that we're seeing is that, and Brett, I think you put it best when you're talking about the Akuba before. I might let you run with that. What were you saying?
Yeah, no, look, I mean, I think one of the reasons why we want to have this chat is behavioral finances makes up 70% of someone's investment making decisions when it comes to managing their money, and we'll always default to what we know. So as Australian tax residents, we buy property. You know, Australia's love affair with property is almost a religion. And when it comes to managing other assets, look, you'll just do what you've done in the past. When you move overseas, the way the tax rules are written, it completely ignores your citizenship. So if you're an Australian moving to the US, moving to the UAE, moving to the UK, you're treated no differently than a Chinese or a Russian or a British investor, pure and simple. Now, you know, we'll obviously have our biases and our proclivities and our favorites in terms of how to manage money. But, you know, as an example here in Dubai, in the UAE, you know, I say when I meet people for the first time, when you fly out of Australia, you need to take the Kuba off and put the Kandura on. And the reason being is because from a tax point of view, we're treated no differently to an Emirati. You know, for someone in the US, they're treated no differently to a US resident and citizen. So you need to, and the tax rules change. People are so ignorant, so confused how the tax rules change when they go overseas, but it's a different country, different rules, different legislation, and you need to embrace that. And, you know, like you and I always talk about with clients, it comes down to almost project managing how you manage your money based on your jurisdiction, based on the tax laws and based on that. People sometimes with finance, I think just, it's too hard. I'll just do the easy way. And yes, you know, that can create wealth, but from a tax optimized scenario, from a, you know, embracing the opportunity, you know, people aren't doing it correctly. And I think that's the big thing we always talk about with clients is, you can do that. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But these are the repercussions. If you do this as an expat, and then when you go back to Australia, then you do that, you know, it adds those percentage points to your balance sheet and you have a far better, you know, far better experience.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think when we do become an expat, become a non-resident, you know, especially if we're being sent overseas by an employer, a lot of the time we're not really given some sort of educational seminar or put through anything with that employer. Yes, we know that the big four accounting firms, you know, they're going to be looking after us. That's great. But at the end of the day, you're an account number to them and you'd be very surprised and shocked at the actual advice you get. It's probably going to be nothing. Give us what you got. We'll go and lodge it. And if it causes issue in the future, well, you know, we're doing what was right for this year. So it does mean that I suppose you need to, you know, take a step back, look at your different assets that you hold, look at your current sort of strategy that you might be running before you become an expat, and what's going to change when you head overseas and you're now a non-resident for tax purposes. What impact is that going to have on your asset classes? Should I be paying out that debt on the mortgage? Should I be putting more into the offset account? Should I be paying down that loan, that margin loan? Is a margin loan right for me if I'm investing in shares? How does that get treated? Can I claim the interest expense on that certain asset now that I'm overseas? How does that change from a tax efficiency point of view? Do I still get the same tax concessions? I can keep going. I won't.
No, you're spot on. And this is exactly why we want to have this conversation, you know, with folks today. Is it's all about adjusting your mindset, because you just go down these rabbit holes. And as an Australian tax resident living in your principal place of residence, all you want to do is crush debt. People then move overseas and they move out of their place, they put a tenant in, but then they continue to pay down that debt in a rapid fashion, like as if they were a tax resident. The reason why you pay down your principal place of residence debt as a tax resident is because it's non-deductible. When you become an expat and a tenant moves in, it is full deductible. If you pay down that debt too quickly, you kill all your deductions in terms of interest costs. And then suddenly you're in positive cash flow paying 32.5% tax on that income when you could have diverted some of that positive cash flow from a new job overseas towards non-taxable assets. And then when you return to Australia, then you pay off the loan as you move back into the property because it's non-deductible. And you've actually achieved you've achieved the end result. You've paid off your debt. You paid off your loan, but you've got more dollars from it because you're accruing wealth in a non-CGT, non-capital gains tax environment, and you're not paying tax on the income, on the rental income, and it's just that sort of double bunger effect.
That's right. And it is a bit of a juggling effect. You know, I guess expats, you know, around the world, depending on where you're based, you know, you're also going to have probably your local tax incentives to kick into the local retirement schemes. I think the UAE, they brought in the DUS or the retirement plan now. Is that
In the DIC, Yeah, we've got DUS, the Dubai, DIC Employee Workplace Savings Scheme. And, and that's, just say that with a few beers under your belt. And it's great. It's 5.83% of your salary for the first 5 years employment gets paid. That's different. That's not provisioned. It's actually paid. So it's a funded pension. And, there's all these sort of things going around that some are compulsory, some are opt-in. But I think, certainly embracing your local capacity in terms of making the most locally. Certainly, if you're going to be overseas for 1 year, you don't want rats and mice and a couple of $1,000s here and a couple of $1,000s there. But that's if right. you do have any view of having any sort of serious tenure overseas, sort of 2 to 5 years, then it makes sense to build money up in these sort of, but also understanding how it works in the repatriation as well too. That's a key point. Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. When to repatriate it, when not to repatriate it, the tax scenarios and that. So it's just, like I said before, project managing your status from a residency point of view and just working your way through it.
That's right. I mean, I think generally if we know we're going to be returning back to Australia, we'll still have a very key focus front of mind that's where we will still accumulate a lot of our assets. If we don't plan to be in a country for, say, more than 5 years, well, we shouldn't be buying a property in that country for 5 years. Remember, property is a long-term holding, probably minimum 7 to 10 years.
With the ins and outs.
That's right. You're still going to incur your stamp duties, your tax in that local country. So if you're only there for 5 years, is actually really worth, obviously taking money over and buying property or investing there locally. Whereas if you are going to end up back in Australia, then, maybe 70% of your overall strategy is geared towards investing back into Australia, different assets, different buckets, but doing it, with a tax-efficient strategy, given that you're a non-resident, not aggressively paying down too much debt, so you're then paying, as Brett put it, 32.5% tax on that income, focusing on maybe a little bit of super. It just depends. It depends on your capacity. I know a key question I get from a lot of expats that are in the US is, do I contribute to a 401k? Or, do I put into a Roth IRA? Or, from an ATO's point of view, it doesn't distinguish between a tax deferred vehicle and after tax vehicle in the US. The tax codes don't line up like that, and unfortunately they probably won't for a very long time. They're not going to go back and revisit that DTA anytime soon. So that's why there's always those considerations. And I guess, you've got to really look at whether you're getting an incentive to put into that retirement vehicle. Is there a tax incentive? Am I getting a deduction, or is it reducing my taxable income in that local country? Because sometimes if it isn't, then is it worth it? If I'm there for, as Brett put it, 12 months or a year, or 2 years, whatever it might be, it just depends.
It does, and I think it's your actions need to map to your intent. If you are severing ties with Australia and establishing yourself as a new domicile in a new country, and it's your home, and you're putting down roots, then you need to map to that scenario. I think. There's no problems at holding assets back in Australia. And we always say, you're always best to accrue wealth in the country you intend to return to or retire to, because currency risk is one of those biggest risks that expats face. Look at the dollar today. It's going in our favor, but in 6 months' time, may not be going in your favor. And it is a mug's game in terms of picking where that currency is going to go. But by accruing wealth in that country you intend to return to, it's there waiting for you. So then when it comes time to return to Australia, it's a matter of just booking the plane ticket and flying home, not going, oh, God, if we only transferred the money yesterday or 2 days' time or 2 weeks' time. You don't want to have that conversation. It's too convoluted. It's impossible to map. And I think from a lot of people's very much an Australian way of that betting mentality, I could have got it when it was 56 cents, and don't try and pick the eyes out of the market, because you only know what the price, whether it's good or bad in hindsight, historically.
Yeah, that's right.
And, certainly when those transferred money back to Australia last year at 56 cents, at the time, sure they're going, oh my God, it's going to go to 52, but I'll do it anyway. Now they look like geniuses. At the time, not so much. So
I agree. And I think when it comes to transferring money back to Australia and currency, I mean, yes, yet the one thing you can control is obviously when you're doing it. Can't control what the FX rate is. So you are better off sitting to more of a bit of a dollar cost averaging, or I guess you could almost call it robotic like plan, because you're removing emotion from that decision every month or every 6 weeks. I'm transferring back $5,000 US, and that's going to be to service whatever mortgage I've got there, or put it in some shares, or put it into super, whatever it might be, depending on the country that you're in. But that's just a sensible approach to obviously spreading out your currency risk over a 12-month period, compared to, you know what, I'm just going to hold this currency for 12 months and then I'll send it all back home. And you don't want to be put in a situation where you've been overseas for 3 years, 5, 10, whatever it might be, and now 95% of your assets are in a foreign currency and that currency's gone backwards. We've seen the days where the currency's been on the other side of parity. Yep. And a lot of those expats are still probably sitting on the fence going, you know, crap, probably should have transferred it back in that time. Unfortunately, there's two ends or two sides to hindsight. It's just making those sensible choices along the way.
Actually happened to two clients of mine with this little vote that happened in 2015 called Brexit. They've been in the UK, one was 8 years, one was 10 years. And they were about to return. They held all their wealth in pounds. And they were just about to return. The vote went the way that no one thought. Pound fell 15%. They had to defer moving back to Australia for 2 years, because the financial haircut in that move would have been too much. So that caused them all the stress. They had to try and renegotiate their jobs back, kids in schools, like it was everything. So I think, you know, managing your finances as a CFO, you know, chief financial officer, and being very structured and practical about it makes a lot more sense from an expat's point of view, because there are a lot more considerations that an expat needs to take into account as opposed to an Australian resident. They don't have to worry about currency. They don't have to worry about all these tax laws overseas. For them, it's just they know the Australian rules, capital gains tax, income tax, off you go, make as much money as you can. Whereas overseas, it's a lot more convoluted. And there's some stupid rules out there that will never change. Denmark's one is great. You know, if you own a foreign domiciled ETF, you'll do a mark-to-market every year on unrealized gains, you know, and you'll pay tax on it. If it's a loss, you won't get a tax credit. So there's a lot of these things out there, and you can, you know, you just need to be aware. You know, you hit the nail on the head when you said at the opening about, you know, if you're being moved by a company and EY or KPMG or Deloitte do a report for you, they're paid by your employer. Your employer is their client. They're doing it for you for a service. So never have I seen any of those reports take into account the financial or tax considerations of that relocation. They will say, that's "G'day, right, James, you're moving to Copenhagen. Well done. Here's the local tax rate, you know, blah, 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 blah." There's two pages of content about the local market. There's two pages of disclaimers, and it's signed by an associate who's been billed out at probably $500 an hour. There is no consideration of your personal situation. There is more of an information, hey, heads up, you know, this is coming. But in terms of everything else, nothing at all. And that's where, you know, ignorance is not bliss. You know, you need to know about these things. It's great that people are reaching out to us before their relocation, which is fantastic. I love that, because we can provide so much value and assistance at the upfront. We don't have a time machine. You can't go back in time and change things before.
No, that's right. I think you and I can both openly admit the amount of stories we've heard where people say to you on a call or a consult or even a client, just, I wish I knew this 2 or 3 years ago. It's like,
it's daily.
It's like, why wasn't I told this when I left? Just like, well, you know, you're looked after by, you know, one of the big four, which their focus isn't to look at your financial situation, your assets, what you're doing right now, and say, this is what's going to change. This is the negative impacts of you becoming a non-resident now and moving to this country. Not at all. They're going to give you that 2 to 5 page memo, which we've seen time and time again. These are your local tax rates. These are the local VATs or whatever it might be. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Nothing about these are your Australian tax considerations now that you're becoming a non-resident, and you know, have a 5 to 10 to 15 page, I suppose, plan around, you know, educating you being a non-resident and what it changes. So definitely need to obviously always do their research around that. But yeah, we, you know, we're always trying to get noisier around that.
Yeah, look, we will. And to us, education is the most powerful thing that we can bring to the expat community, and informing people and helping them make good decisions. You know, it's not hard when you break everything down and, you know, like we call it, two-dimensional advice, you just need to take into account both considerations, how do those dots join, and then maximize that, take advantage of that. You know, now's your time to do that, because I think that's the thing we see is finance is number 50 in people's priority list, you know, brunches and holidays and those sort of things, and more of a consideration. But at the end of the day, you know, when it comes time to return to Oz, you want to have something to show for your time away, not just photos. You actually want to have that metaphorical briefcase full of cash that says, yes, I've had a great time. It was great for my career. The family loved it. And financially, we're better off from going through that experience.
Yeah, exactly right. You do want to be able to accept that role overseas with confidence, knowing, okay, at the end of the 5 or 10 year period, I will have enough to buy a main residence. Well, I'll have enough that I would have been able to pay down the main residence debt, and I've invested in, you know, another property or shares, or put some in super. Or by taking this stint overseas for 5 or 10 years, I'm now 10 years ahead of retirement planning. But, you know, those sort of obviously considerations and getting it down to that one number or that one sort of strategy is going to help. But I guess with that in mind, it's still baffling that a lot of employers do not do that kind of additional research for sending their employees overseas. It's jarring, to be honest, because it's a lot of the time where things aren't looked after correctly, and it's not until 2 or 3 or 4 years later when you find out that, oh crap, I've got either a very large tax bill, I've got, you know, these kind of consideration. A big one that I've actually noticed that does come up in the last couple of years is actually land tax. Expats heading overseas, they own a property mainly, I'd say, down in New South Wales or Victoria, even the inner city rounds or circles, I should say. And because that property's changed from being a main residence to now just an investment, the land tax comes out of nowhere. Like, oh shit!
Yeah.
The land tax, I wasn't paying this 2 years ago. Well, of course you weren't. It was a main residence. It was held under, it was exempt.
They so start getting $20,000-$30,000 tax bills.
Yeah. They do, absolutely. And a lot of expats aren't aware that the interest that the state revenue office can whack on that, it is ridiculously high.
It's high.
You know, it's it can be double figures, you know, 10, 11, 12%. And I guess you can somewhat try and plead ignorance. Go, I didn't know that. How was I supposed to know that? Well, it's your responsibility as a property owner. And it's also your responsibility now that your tax situation has changed, but no one educates you on this.
That's right. That's right. And I remember looking at the numbers, the hard numbers years ago, and from a global mobility point of view, I can't remember the cost of moving a manager or an executive overseas from a company's point of view. It's not cheap. You know, depending on who you are, you know, mid to high six digits or low seven digits, it's quite an expensive exercise. Number one reason for failing a expatriate move, relationships in terms of, you know, spouse, partner, those sort of things. Number two, finances.
Yeah. Yep.
Number two is right behind it. And people get overseas, they realize, wait a minute, you know, what I thought was going to be the case, not the case financially. Or they get these bills out of the blue and it creates marital stress. You know, obviously one of the biggest causes of divorce is money. And it gets compounded, you know, when you're in the furnace of being an expat, which, you know, isn't the easy laid-back lifestyle that a lot of people think it is. It is a lot of stress being an expat, but combine that with tax, combine that with marital stress, combine that with all these things, you know, one result happens and it's not good.
That's right. I mean, the expat couples or family that you do see, obviously, you know, there's obviously undue stress put on them when it comes to the financial considerations, but it's usually if there's a trailing spouse, they might become the money manager. You've got obviously the breadwinner and then the money manager, and they're a team. You know, they're working collectively as their own sort of self-employed company. And those obviously work out quite well when it comes to money decisions. You're putting under stress and one person's handling it. Yeah, obviously that's when you can see the separations and divorces come about. And there's always going to be tax considerations around that with the assets back home.
Yeah, just remember Donald Rumsfeld, you know, there's the known knowns, the known unknowns, the unknown unknowns. And you know, you want to find out as many known knowns, and it's more so than unknown unknowns that you're not aware of, because they can have the biggest ramifications. You know, people sell their former principal place of residence while they're overseas because they didn't know about the main residence exemption change. You know, we're seeing tax bills in six figures, and they're not, you know, people are almost throwing up and in tears when they find out about it.
Yeah.
But They didn't know.
That's right. And I mean, that's a really important one as well. That main resin sale, that's something that it obviously can't be unwound. And now that they've removed that CGT concession or the main resin exemption, why wasn't it the responsibility of the big four to make sure they didn't educate them on that? So listen, you've got these assets, we can see that.
Yeah.
This is what you need to make sure if you do choose to sell that main residence. That should come from a tax accountant that, you know, obviously your employer is paying for, you know, to give you that tax advice. But time and time and again, we see often isn't.
Yeah. So, mate, you and I could go on forever, but I think we'll, I think we've made our point in terms of, people taking this seriously because, yeah, we do sit on a daily basis and it's not through ignorance or stupidity. It's just, you know, they're just not aware. You know, and just getting those, fine-tuning those outcomes just makes the whole experience a lot more positive. People feel in control. They feel like they're maximising the chances that they've been given. It's those little bits and pieces. So, yeah, just a big shout-out to the listeners and the watchers out there. Guys, just if that's you, if you are managing your money in a mindset as an Australian resident or, and we do come across this from time to time, you are taking advice from Australian family members, you know, and how to manage your money, don't forget you're in a completely different kettle of fish, you know, to their situation. So what works for them may not work for you. You know, definitely speak to us, speak to someone else. We don't care who you speak to, but just speak to someone in terms of how to optimize your scenario because, it's your money at the end of the day. And, you know, this is a nice little segue to do a shout out to, we've got a Facebook group called the Australian Expat Financial Forum and free to join 1100, 1200 members in there. Everyone's sharing different questions and queries about how to manage the money as an expat. So, by all means, go on there and join. There's a couple of questions that we use to sort the wheat from the chafe in terms of the spammers. But if you just on Facebook, go to Australian Expat Financial Forum and join, you'll find a lot more information comes through there, both from us. You know, we do release a lot of our updates through there, but also to your fellow expats, you know, get on there and have a chat. So, and also we've had a couple more reviews since the last podcast. So thank you very much to those out there. Guys, keep it up. You know, the more, as James said before, we're trying to get noisy. We're trying to educate expats. It's all we're, you know, passionate about doing is making sure guys and girls out there know what to do, when to do it, how to do it. So reviews, feedback, likes, subscribes, all that sort of nonsense. It definitely helps us in getting out there and educating expats. So
that's right. And I think we're all holding our breath at the moment to know what they're going to do with these residency changes. I thought we would have seen an EN by now. It's coming to the end of August. So when are we going to get that explanatory memorandum? Maybe end of September, who knows?
I think with Australia on fire right now and the government's focus on purely getting vaccines, you know, the longer they leave it, the less chance of 1 July 2022, if that was a date that we're going to consider. You know, they've still got to put it through the lower house, upper house, all that sort of nonsense. So I don't know. We'll see. You and I are watching it on a daily basis. You know, we're sitting there with bated breath, but nothing so far.
No. Yeah, no. It's, it's difficult and frustrating. But I guess, the longer the Australia is on fire to a degree, you know, the longer until they make those changes, which might actually impact a lot of expats in those unusual grey areas. So
100%.
It's a tough one.
Yeah, 100%. So, mate, we'll leave it there. And thank you to those out there watching and listening. And if you have any questions, by all means, you know, go to our website, www.atlaswealth.com. You can also drop James and I an email at info@atlaswealth.com. But, mate, we'll catch you on the next episode.
Sounds good, mate. Speak soon.
Cheers. Take care.
Cheers.